Hachette Audio presents Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. Written by Annie Jacobson. Read by the author. For Kevin. I am tired and sick of war. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have never fired a shot, nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, for vengeance, for desolation. War is hell. General William Tecumseh Sherman, attributed 1863. Author's note on sources. This is a nonfiction book about complex individuals working in treacherous environments populated with killers, connivers, and saboteurs. In reporting this book, I sat for hundreds of hours with sources who recounted to me situations of sheer pandemonium and chaos entwined with the human will to survive and the intellectual challenge of not giving up hope. Some interviews took place in sources' homes, others in the anonymity of roadside diners. One interview took place on horseback up in the mountains, an off-the-grid location where that particular source felt comfortable speaking. Halfway into our outing, as we were riding along in the otherwise quiet forest, we heard screaming, unmistakably a woman's voice. A figure on horseback rounded the bend, the terrified rider hanging on for dear life as her horse galloped out of control, reins dangerously askew. My source, a Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, paramilitary operator, leapt off his horse, positioned himself in the wide path, and deftly grabbed the reins of the 1,000-pound animal as it charged by. I knew he had a background with horses, but it was extraordinary to witness how quickly and intuitively he brought a dramatic and potentially dangerous situation under control. "There you go, ma'am," my source said to the breathless rider, handing the reins back to her. He asked if she needed further assistance, which she declined. In the chaos of the action, his shirt came untucked, and I noticed he carried a Sig Sauer P320 semi-automatic pistol at his back, near his buttocks. He checked it for safety and climbed back on his horse, and we rode on. Reporting a book about the shadow world of CIA covert action operations requires determining first who can be trusted, and then how to fact-check their stories. Covert action is, by its very nature, designed and orchestrated to remain hidden from public scrutiny. The majority of the covert action operations around the world that I describe were orchestrated to be plausibly denied. And yet, 42 men and women with first-hand knowledge of these events allowed me to interview them for this book. Dozens of other individuals who played ancillary roles in the action were also interviewed. Every primary source came to me by referral, which is how I've reported and written 4 previous nonfiction books. To verify facts, I reviewed sources' military service records, exceptional performance awards, medals, passports, real and pseudonymous, identification cards, journals, diaries, and more. How to fact-check sources' stories. The CIA and its intelligence community partners guard their secrets through a complex array of code words, cover stories, and operational names. Through Freedom of Information Act, FOIA requests, and pre-existing declassification efforts, I accessed thousands of pages of documents from the CIA, the Departments of Defense and State, and other government entities, housed in the National Archives and elsewhere, cited in the notes and bibliography. And this book would not exist without the work of other journalists, scholars, and historians whose books, monographs, papers, and news articles I have duly cited. Those interviewed for this book served 13 presidents, 7 Democrats, 6 Republicans, from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. They include 2 surviving members of the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, 8 individuals who served the CIA at the Senior Intelligence Service, SIS, level, equivalent to an ambassador at the State Department or a general at the Defense Department, 11 chiefs of station from countries on 5 continents, numerous chiefs of base who served in some of the world's most dangerous outposts, including in Sudan, Yemen, Iraq, and Afghanistan, 19 operators from the Special Activities Division, Ground Branch, an attorney at the CIA who wrote scores of classified presidential findings, starting with those on the Iran hostage crisis, and was uniquely helpful in clarifying executive office-level decision-making. Every operation reported in this book, however shocking, was legal. Other sources shared information with me on background to assist in my understanding of the subject matter, but without direct attribution to them. Prologue. Some might say this is a book about assassination, but really it is a book about covert action, tertia optio, the president's third option, when the first option, diplomacy, is inadequate, and the second, war, is a terrible idea. All covert action is classified, designed to be plausibly denied, and because of this, it is sometimes called the president's hidden hand. The most extreme of all hidden hand operations involves killing a leader or prominent person, and this book focuses on that act. The president's third option was born in the wake of World War II, and those who created it did so to avert World War III. With its ethos in unconventional warfare, the Central Intelligence Agency officers and operators who conduct covert action were originally called the president's guerrilla warfare corps. The same legal construct that allowed national security advisors for Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy to plot to kill foreign leaders like Fidel Castro also allowed Presidents Bush and Obama to create a system in which prominent people can be placed on a kill or capture list to be targeted and killed. This authority remains in effect today. Targeted killing is not limited to high-technology drone strikes. The president's guerrilla warfare corps kills enemies mano a mano in close-quarters combat when necessary. The group that has the authority to conduct these lethal operations outside a war zone on the ground is the CIA's Special Activities Division. One of its most lethal components is called Ground Branch. The origins of the Special Activities Division, including its Ground Branch, lie in the CIA's precursor agency, the Office of Strategic Services, and specifically its Special Operations SO branch, a guerrilla warfare corps whose goal was to kill Nazis, to sabotage and subvert the Third Reich. The motto of one unit, the OSS Jedburghs, was surprise, kill, vanish. The OSS was modeled after a wartime British organization, also classified, called Special Operations Executive, SOE. The idea that most people find hand-to-hand killing repugnant, but mechanized killing somehow more palatable, is central to this book. From the early days of the OSS Special Operations Branch to the present-day activities of the CIA's Ground Branch, the most ruthless and risky lethal operations have evolved and transformed. Over the decades, killing a leader or prominent person under the rubric of covert action has been called many things by those who plan and oversee operations, but never assassination, because assassination is illegal. Killing a leader or prominent person at the behest of the president is legal under Title 50 of the U.S. Code. President Dwight Eisenhower's advisors discussed eliminating foreign leaders, and they set up a health alteration committee to neutralize or disable certain people. They spoke in riddles to uphold the construct of plausible deniability, Congress later found. President John F. Kennedy's advisors formalized killing and called it executive action. To President Ronald Reagan, the construct became preemptive neutralization, eliminating terrorists before they had a chance to strike again. Under President George W. Bush, the term lethal direct action was used. Under President Barack Obama, killing terrorists became known publicly as targeted killing. The question arises, how does killing any one person advance U.S. foreign policy objectives? This book aims to shine some light on how and why certain leaders and prominent people are targeted and killed. In the early days of covert action, there was no oversight. In the mid-1970s, after the Church Committee hearings produced a report called Alleged Assassination Plots Involving Foreign Leaders, oversight was given to Congress, where it remains today. Covert action orders are formalized by CIA lawyers in a presidential finding or Memorandum of Notification, MON, to be signed by the president. John A. Rizzo, former chief legal officer for the CIA, who served seven presidents and wrote scores of these covert action findings, including the Memorandum of Notification that authorized lethal direct action against terrorists as of September 17, 2001, which remains in effect today, goes on record in this book. William D. Waugh, one of the oldest, longest-serving covert action operators in the United States, and a highly decorated U.S. Army Green Beret, makes up the core of this book. His is an extraordinary life spent dedicated to perfecting the art of covert action. Covert action is assigned to the CIA in peacetime, but run jointly by the Defense Department during war. Because foreign governments, non-state actors, and lone wolf assassins regularly try to kill America's commander-in-chief, it is important to also understand how deterrence against assassination is the other side of the covert action coin. This part of the narrative is told through the lens of Louis C. Merletti, the 19th director of the U.S. Secret Service, and a former member of the counter-assault team, CAT, the paramilitary force of the U.S. Secret Service. Like Waugh, Merletti's unconventional warfare expertise comes from his combat experiences in Vietnam as a Green Beret. I first started thinking about assassination in 2009. When I was working as a reporter for the Los Angeles Times magazine. A source visited my home on the way back from the Middle East. He worked in counterterrorism. That was the extent of what he could say about his employment situation. I knew him to be an expert weapons handler. He almost always traveled with gun cases. And yet, the commemorative medallion he showed me from his most recent travels read, American Embassy, Kabul, Afghanistan. Nothing in his area of expertise was related to diplomacy as far as I knew, but we both understood it was best to leave it at that. My two sons were young at the time and dozens of G.I. Joes, from the Revolutionary War era to the 21st century, filled our California house and yard. At the boys' request, the source painstakingly identified G.I. Joe's unique weapons: Confederate rifles with bayonets, M1 Garands, AK-47s, M16 rifles. Later, the source asked if it was okay to show my boys two real firearms for educational purposes. He was a licensed weapons safety instructor and had twice taken me shooting. I said yes. Watching carefully as he showed my children a sidearm and a compacted sniper rifle, I noticed that there was one case he never opened. Later that evening, I asked him privately what was inside. He opened it, revealing a large, serrated knife. "What's that for?" I asked, almost immediately realizing my mistake. "Sometimes a job requires quiet," he said. He closed the case. Neither of us said another word. That was the moment I realized the obvious. The United States kills its enemies, not only in high-technology drone strikes, but at close range. I later learned from another source that my house guest worked for the CIA's Special Activities Division, Ground Branch. This encounter stayed with me, as did the idea of close quarters killing and my reaction to it. I could imagine my house guest killing an Al-Qaeda fighter using a sniper rifle, but the idea of him cutting someone's throat or thrusting it in a man's ribs gave me pause. Why? And why is all covert action secret, classified, designed for the president to deny and the public to never know? My source never spoke of his work in the Middle East, not before he showed me the knife and not after. It was understood that his work was classified. Hidden programs are notorious places to cover up failure, to conceal egregious mistakes. I wondered if dispatching paramilitary operators around the world to conduct lethal, covert action operations was all too often a recipe for disaster, or, instead, mostly a weaponized strength. Is killing a person decreed by the president to be a threat to U.S. national security right or wrong, moral or immoral, honorable or dishonorable? I found answers in writing this book. I hope readers find theirs. Part 1, 1941. Chapter 1, An Office for Ungentlemanly Warfare. It was the first Sunday in December 1941, and the boy selling popcorn behind the concession stand at the Strand Theater in Bastrop, Texas, had just turned 12. His name was William Dawson Waugh, but everyone called him Billy. Shortly after 2 p.m., Sheriff Ed Cartwright walked into the theater with a terrible look on his face. He told Billy Waugh to run upstairs, have the projectionist shut off the film, and turn on the lights. Taking the stairs two at a time, Waugh did as instructed. From high above in the projectionist booth, he watched as the room full of moviegoers squinted and complained about the movie being interrupted. Then Sheriff Cartwright walked onto the stage and everyone fell silent. "Listen up," the sheriff said. "The Japanese just attacked Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Pacific Fleet was destroyed and thousands of Americans were dead. What would happen next was anyone's guess," the sheriff said, "but it would be foolhardy to rule out the possibility of another attack." Sheriff Cartwright told everyone to go home and cover their windows with blackout material, listen to the radio, and stay informed. Billy Waugh stayed behind, watching the moviegoers file out. After he finished cleaning up, he went home to the house where he lived with his mother, Lillian, a part-time schoolteacher, and his older sister, Nancy. The next day, Congress declared war on Japan. 3 days after that, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States, and Congress then declared war on Germany and Italy. With America at war around the world, Billy Waugh made a vow to himself. One day, I'll go to war too. The day Pearl Harbor bombed the United States in a surprise attack remained imprinted on his mind. By that time, 1941, Billy Waugh knew more about war than most 12-year-old boys. He'd been absorbing information from the newsreels that played before Strand Theater films. Hitler's campaign, Blitzkrieg, or Lightning War, astounded him. The idea of total war, of all-out victory at any human cost, was mind-boggling and frightening. "It is not right that matters, but victory," Hitler told his generals. "Act brutally, be harsh and remorseless. The success of the best is by means of force." Of all the tactics and techniques being used by the Nazis in the invasion of Western Europe, it was the boldness of the paratrooper unit, Fallschirmjäger, that left Billy Waugh thunderstruck. Newsreel films showed Nazi commandos leaping out of airplanes and parachuting into the war theater to launch deadly surprise attacks. Then there was the paraglider attack at the Belgian fortress Eben-Emael, once considered the most impenetrable fortress in the world. 78 Nazi paratroopers, piloting gliders and armed with flamethrowers, landed on the rooftop of the fortress and overtook 650 Belgian defenders, a victory from which the Belgian army never recovered. 1 month after the Nazis captured Eben-Emael, the U.S. Army created its own paratrooper division in Fort Benning, Georgia, the first in American history. Every spare moment Billy Waugh had, in between school and the three part-time jobs he worked as a paperboy, stock boy, and popcorn popper, he gathered information about these U.S. paratroopers. The most important items for a successful parachute jump, he learned, were the boots. They were tall, to mid-shin, with rawhide laces and stitching across the toe. Billy Waugh became focused on owning a pair of his own. His alcoholic father had died of cirrhosis of the liver when Billy was 10. The money he earned from his after-school jobs went to his mother to help pay for the family's living expenses. Now, with a clear goal in mind, he began skimming nickels and dimes off his earnings. When he finally saved up $7, he hitchhiked 30 miles to Austin, and bought himself a pair of paratrooper boots. Elated, he felt a step closer to one day becoming a U.S. paratrooper. The world was all right. Across the Atlantic, war raged in Europe. It was May 27, 1942, and in the Czech town of Holšovice, the Nazi general riding in an armor-plated Mercedes-Benz had been targeted for assassination. SS Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich was a Janus-like creature. Blonde, blue-eyed, and beautiful, his skin smooth and pale like that of a porcelain doll, but he was also a monster, cruel and sadistic beyond measure. His own boss, Adolf Hitler, described Heydrich as a man with an iron heart. A secret unit inside British intelligence sought to kill him. The assassination plot was called Operation Anthropoid. Concealed on a hillside not far from where Heydrich was driving his Mercedes, two British-trained assassins lay in wait. Jan Kubisch and Josef Gobček, both Czech nationals in their mid-20s, were members of a classified British commando unit that existed inside the British Secret Intelligence Service's Section 6, MI6. Only an elite few were aware that these commando units were part of an underground paramilitary army working under the bland-sounding cover name Special Operations Executive. Kubish and Gobchak had been assigned to SOE's Division D for destruction, and their work was based on unconventional warfare tactics, also called guerrilla warfare. The existence of SOE was a source of great controversy within the British military establishment. Most British generals believed war was first and foremost about chivalry and honor, that it must be fought in adherence to the laws of war. While no single document can be identified as the ancient source from which the laws of war have evolved, modern-day codes of conduct stem from the Liber Code, a set of 157 rules written by lawyer and university professor Francis Liber during the American Civil War. Issued on April 24, 1863, by President Abraham Lincoln as General Order No. 100, these rules were to serve as a uniform code of conduct governing the behavior of the Union Army, the Confederate Army, and the armies of Europe. They were later expanded upon in Hague Convention resolutions of 1899 and 1907. Rule 148 of the Liber Code explicitly prohibited assassination. Civilized nations look with horror upon offers of rewards for the assassination of enemies as relapses into barbarism, Liber wrote. Guerrilla fighters were labeled insidious enemies and therefore not entitled to the protections of the laws of war. War, like sport, was to be a gentleman's game. Guerrilla warfare was most ungentlemanly, based as it was on treacherous principles like sabotage and subversion. Sabotage during World War II meant blowing up trains, bridges, and production plants behind enemy lines, situations in which civilians would likely be killed. Subversion, or undermining the authority of an occupying force, required a host of dirty tricks and deceptive acts, including assassination. But Prime Minister Winston Churchill believed that SOE Division D was necessary, and he personally approved of every mission it undertook. Because guerrilla warfare in general, and SOE operations in particular, were considered ungentlemanly, the SOE became known as Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Commandos like Kubish and Gobchak were trained to infiltrate enemy-occupied territory, perform hit-and-run operations, and then disappear. The short-term goal of their efforts was to create paranoia among Nazi officials and embolden underground resistance movements. The long-term goal of the SOE was to prepare the battlefield for an upcoming Allied invasion. In Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia, Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich was in charge. He was also one of the most influential and powerful generals in the vast Nazi war machine. Heydrich reported directly to Heinrich Himmler, the ambitious, sadistic Reichsführer whose evil knew no bounds. Heydrich created and supervised the Einsatzgruppen, extermination squads, whose 3,000 members shot and killed more than 1 million men, women, and children during the war. He served as one of the main architects of the Final Solution and personally initiated the deportation and mass murder of European Jews. In 1942, he was at the top of SOE's kill list. At SOE, the Heydrich assassination operation was handled jointly by two men, Major General Sir Colin McVean Gubbins, a decorated World War I hero and SOE's director of operations, and František Moravec, the former chief of Czech military intelligence, then living in England in exile. As with most SOE commandos, Jan Kubish and Josef Gobchak had been hand-picked for bravery, cunning, and a willingness to ruthlessly kill. The whole art of guerrilla warfare lies in striking the enemy where he least expects it, and yet where he is most vulnerable, Gubbins instructed his men. Inflict the maximum amount of damage in a short time and get away. The SOE considered assassination a necessary dark art, a way to weaken the Nazis' impenetrable hold on power. A successful operation required months of planning by Govins and Moravshek, followed by months of intense training and rehearsing by Kubisch and Gobchek. Much of the work took place in a classified SOE facility in Scotland, codenamed Training Center STS-25. Here, the assassins trained in guerrilla warfare tactics, including hand-to-hand combat, sharpshooting, cover and concealment, and the manufacture of homemade bombs. They learned map reading and code deciphering, how to slit the throat of a sentry or guard without making a sound. Finally given the green light, Kubisch and Gobchek were flown in under cover of darkness by a British pilot and a crew of five. They jumped out of the aircraft over a village just east of Prague and parachuted in behind enemy lines. Safely on the ground, the two commandos met up with resistance fighters who hid them from discovery until they were ready to strike. On May 27, 1942, the moment arrived. There, in Nazi-occupied Holzhowitza, Kubisch and Gobchek lay camouflaged in the grass. They'd arrived to the target area on bicycles, now stashed in a nearby grove of trees. Each man had a pistol in his pocket. Gobchek carried a Sten submachine gun. Kubisch held the assassination weapon, an anti-tank grenade that had been specially modified by British explosives expert Cecil Clark. The small bomb needed to be powerful enough to shatter the armored plating on Heydrich's Mercedes so as to kill him, but light enough to be accurately thrown by Jan Kubisch. High on the hill above the assassins, a signal mirror flashed. Heydrich's Mercedes had been spotted by a local Czech accomplice, Josef Valčík. Soon the car would round the corner and approach where Kubisch and Gobchek were concealed. The planning had been meticulously mapped out. The geography of the land was such that at mid-hill, the road twisted into a hairpin turn, meaning Heydrich's chauffeur would be forced to brake and slow down. Kubisch and Gobchek would have a 5-second window to kill Reinhard Heydrich and flee. As the car made its way down the hill, the assassins could see that the top of Heydrich's Mercedes 320 convertible B was open wide. Opportunity at hand, Gobchek stood up, released the catch on his Sten submachine gun, and rushed toward the sharpest point in the road's curve. As the Mercedes braked and decelerated, Gobchek took aim and fired, bracing himself for a powerful explosion of gunfire. Instead, a catastrophic misfire. Nothing but the impotent click of the weapon as it failed to fire. Gobchek, now standing there in the road, was mortally exposed. Heydrich's driver screeched to a full stop. SS Oberscharführer Johannes Klein was an imposing Nazi chauffeur and bodyguard. 6'3", he was trained in the art of tactical military driving. Had he followed Third Reich protocol, Klein would have accelerated and sped away. But Heydrich apparently ordered Klein to stop the car. With Gobchek still standing next to the Mercedes, Heydrich pulled his Luger from its holster, stood up in the convertible, and began shooting at Gobchek. What Reinhard Heydrich failed to realize was that a second SOE-trained assassin was nearby. Jan Kubisch moved into action. Following protocols learned over months of SOE commando training, he stepped forward and hurled the incendiary device into Heydrich's Mercedes. In the chaos of the moment, he missed. Instead, the bomb exploded against the car's right rear fender, sending glass and metal shards flying through the air. Reinhard Heydrich was hit by debris. Not realizing he'd been wounded, Heydrich got out of the car and continued firing. Ditching his faulty submachine gun, Gobshek returned fire with his pistol. Enraged, Heydrich lumbered toward his assassin as Gobshek sought cover behind a telephone pole. As the smoke from the car bomb cleared, Kubisch emerged bleeding from a head wound. One witness described blood pouring down his forehead into his eyes. Klein exited the car and began firing at Kubisch. Improbably, the bodyguard's gun also jammed, affording Kubisch time to flee. Gobchek remained pinned down behind the telephone pole, engaged in a lethal exchange of gunfire with Heydrich. But as Heydrich charged, still firing at Gobchek, he suddenly and dramatically collapsed in the road. The debris from the bomb had penetrated his skin and lodged in his organs. Adolf Hitler's powerful deputy lay stricken on the pavement, unable to move. "Get that bastard," Heydrich shouted at Klein, pointing in the direction of Gobchek as he fled. The chauffeur chased the assassins across a field, leaving Heydrich writhing in pain on the road. Kubisch and Gobchek escaped. Heydrich was rushed to nearby Bulovka Hospital, where three of the Nazis' most senior doctors came to his aid. Theodor Morell, Hitler's personal physician, Karl Brandt, Nazi health commissioner, and Karl Gebhardt, chief surgeon of the Waffen-SS, concluded that Heydrich's diaphragm was torn and that the grenade fragments were embedded in his spine, not necessarily life-threatening injuries. But the three physicians overlooked the fact that tiny bits of horsehair from the upholstered seats of the Mercedes had lodged into Heydrich's spleen. Just a few days later, on June 4, 1942, the man with the iron heart died from septicemia or blood poisoning. When Hitler learned of Heydrich's assassination, he became enraged. Privately, he blamed Reinhard Heydrich for his own careless death. Since it is opportunity which makes not only the thief but also the assassin, such heroic gestures as driving in an open, unarmored vehicle or walking about the streets unguarded are just damn stupidity which serves the fatherland not one whit, Hitler said on the day Heydrich died. That a man as irreplaceable as Heydrich should expose himself to unnecessary danger, I can only condemn as stupid and idiotic. Publicly, Hitler demanded revenge. That the assassins had been able to escape and go into hiding was an outrageous insult to the Third Reich. At Heydrich's funeral in Berlin, Hitler ordered his ministers in Prague to find the assassins or else. The reprisals were brutal, indiscriminate, and far-reaching. The barbaric idea was to terrify the Czech people by completely destroying a village at random, said František Moravec, former chief of Czech military intelligence and the man who'd trained the assassins. Northeast of Prague, the Gestapo cordoned off Lidice, rounded up all 173 male inhabitants, and executed them in the village square. 300 women and children were sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp for extermination. The houses in the village were set on fire, then bulldozed over so no trace remained. The operation was executed with such thoroughness that even the persons who happened to be absent from the village on the night of the destruction were gradually located and executed, said Moravec. A reward of 1,000,000 Reichsmarks was offered for information on the assassin's whereabouts. A local Nazi collaborator named Alois Krall revealed that Jan Kubisch and Josef Gabczak were hiding in the basement of a Russian Orthodox church in Prague. Nazi commandos stormed the church, and when they determined that Kubisch and Gabczak were located in the tunnels below, they flooded the basement with water. Kubisch tried to fight his way out, but was mortally wounded. Gabczak, knowing he would soon be killed or captured, swallowed a cyanide pill given to him by the SOE. Both men's bodies were recovered and buried in a mass grave. The reprisals did not end in Lediza. 5 days later, Nazis raised Lejaki after a shortwave radio transmission was found to have been sent from the village to the British. All 33 residents and their children were killed. The following week, 115 people accused of being members of the Czech resistance were executed. Heydrich's successor, SS General Kurt Dallug, boasted that in retaliation for killing Reinhard Heydrich, 1,331 Czech citizens were executed and another 3,000 Jews exterminated. Was it worth it? 5,000 Czechs paid with their lives for the death of a single Nazi maniac, Moravec lamented after the war. In 1945, after the Germans surrendered, Moravec returned to Prague to speak with Alois Krall, imprisoned and awaiting trial for Nazi collaboration. "Greetings, brother," Krall said sarcastically to Moravec when the two men met. "Brother?" asked Moravec, astonished. "I killed 2 Czechs. You killed 5,000. Which of us hangs?" Krall asked. It was Krall who was hanged. General Moravec watched the execution. By then, Czechoslovakia had become part of the communist Soviet bloc. After the execution, as Moravec walked away, he stopped to ask a question of a communist functionary, a Czech national, a man familiar with the Heydrich case. "Will you please tell me where Kubisch and Gabczak are buried?" Moravec asked. "Nowhere," came the abrupt answer. "There are no graves. You foot-kissers of the British are not going to have that excuse to build a statue and hang wreaths. Czech heroes are communists now." And so it goes. Wars are fought. One side wins, the other side loses. Some go home, others become casualties. Freed from Nazi rule, the Czechs lived under a communist-led government that answered to another tyrant, Joseph Stalin. For the second time in a decade, František Moravec fled his country, this time for America. There, the former head of Czech military intelligence took a job as an advisor to the U.S. Department of Defense, where he worked until suffering a heart attack in 1966. He died in the parking lot of the Pentagon, seated in the front seat of his car. To the SOE, the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich was necessary and justified. The spectacle killing of a top Nazi general poked holes in the armor of the Nazi war machine. To the general Czech population, it made the strong appear weak. Inside the Third Reich, the meticulously planned and executed assassination operation gave rise to fear and paranoia among other Nazi officials. When Winston Churchill was briefed on Operation Anthropoid, he expressed approval. When U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt asked whether the British had a hand in Heydrich's assassination, Churchill is said to have winked. In Washington, D.C., a retired World War I general and recipient of the Medal of Honor named William J. Donovan had been trying for years to get President Roosevelt to authorize an unconventional warfare organization modeled after SOE. 2 weeks after Reinhard Heydrich's assassination, Donovan got his wish. As per Executive Order 9182, the Office of Strategic Services was born, a closely held secret at the time, but now famously known as the wartime predecessor of the CIA. Under the authority of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, OSS would work in partnership with SOE. William J. Donovan was made director, and within days of creation, recruiting for OSS was in full swing. At Fort Polk in Louisiana, U.S. Army officer Aaron Bank, 40, was restless and bored. It had been 17 months since the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, and the same amount of time since Bank had requested troop assignment. He was burning to see combat. But in the eyes of the U.S. Army, Aaron Bank was too old. And so instead, he'd been assigned to a railroad battalion, overseeing soldiers lay tracks connecting Fort Polk to Camp Claiborne 50 miles away. "My spirits were low with such unrewarding duties," he told a friend. One day in the spring of 1943, passing the adjutant's tent, Bank spotted a notice on a bulletin board. The Army was looking for volunteers. The notice read, "Likelihood of a dangerous mission guaranteed. Knowledge of French or another European language was the only requirement, but volunteers would need to qualify as paratroopers." "My pulse quickened," Bank later recalled. "A ray of hope appeared." Fluent in French and eager to jump out of airplanes, Bank signed up. A few days later, he received orders. He was to report to the Q building in Washington, D.C., wearing civilian clothes. Aaron Bank did not yet know it, but he'd been assigned to the OSS, to its Special Operations Branch, the American equivalent of SOE's Division D. The mandate of the Special Operations Branch was to effect physical subversion of the enemy in three distinct phases: infiltrate, prepare the battlefield, and conduct sabotage and subversion. Bank was assigned to the French operational group for Operation Jedburgh. Initial training took place at a secret facility in Prince William Forest Park in Virginia that went by the code name Area B. Volunteers learned right away the kinds of commando operations they were being prepared for. "Either you kill or capture, or you will be killed or captured," the Jedburghs were told, an instruction that was emphasized by the Fairborn Sykes OSS stiletto knife issued to members. The double-edged weapon, designed exclusively for surprise attack and killing, resembled a dagger. Its foil grip and slender blade made for easy penetration into a man's ribcage. How best to use the now legendary Fairburn Sykes stiletto in hand-to-hand combat was taught to the Jedburghs by Lieutenant Colonel William E. Fairburn, one of the knife's designers. In close-quarters fighting, there is no more deadly weapon than the knife. An entirely unarmed man has no certain defense against it, Fairburn explained. Of Fairburn's training, a young recruit named Richard Helms had this to say: "Within 15 seconds, I came to realize that my private parts were in constant jeopardy." Helms would one day serve as the 8th Director of Central Intelligence. In addition to the art of knife fighting, Jedburghs learned pistol shooting and grenade throwing, how to kill a man with a pencil to the throat, how to garrote an enemy with piano wire. In evade and escape training, they practiced rope climbing and map reading, how to cross a raging river and scale a cliff. To master the art of sabotage, the Jedburghs learned to construct bombs powerful enough to blow up bridges, canal locks, and industrial plants. to infiltrate territory laced with landmines. They practiced on an obstacle course laced with small explosive charges and called Demolition Trail. Trainees were told to keep their heads down and stay low. The only injury recorded was sustained by a young officer who broke his jaw and lost several teeth in a small explosion. The injured commando, William J. Casey, would one day serve as the 16th director of Central Intelligence under President Ronald Reagan. The OSS trained its agents to work from a mindset that was diametrically opposed to U.S. Army doctrine at the time. Conventional warfare was based upon frontal assault against an enemy's main line of resistance, on colossal tank battles combined with air power and army ground force assault. Guerrilla warfare, also called unconventional warfare and irregular warfare, was the opposite. Close quarters combat and throat slitting were par for the course. Whereas infantry soldiers followed strict orders within a chain of command, Jedbergs were trained in the art of self-reliance. They were volunteering for mysterious, often solo assignments involving improvisation on the ground. OSS Chief William Donovan believed in the necessity of guerrilla warfare, a sentiment he conveyed to President Roosevelt in a letter housed at the National Archives. "My observation is that the more the battle machines are perfected, the greater the need in modern warfare of men, calculatingly reckless with disciplined daring, who are trained for aggressive action," Donovan said. "It will mean a return to our old tradition of the scouts, the raiders, and the rangers," he insisted, in a reference to the unconventional warfare tactics used during the American Revolution. To understand and embrace OSS-style guerrilla warfare was to reject preconceived notions of honor, chivalry, and fair play as the gentleman's way of war. "What I want you to do is get the dirtiest, bloodiest ideas in your head that you can think of for destroying a human being," SOE's founder, General Gubbins, educated the Jedbergs. "The fighting I'm going to show you is not a sport. It's every time and always fight to the death." After 6 weeks, Aaron Bank and 55 American Jedbergs were sent to England for more advanced training, this time with their British, French, and Belgian counterparts. On the Scottish shores of Loch Nancall, at the Victorian lodge called Ersich House, the Jedbergs learned how to operate under extreme duress, how to stay awake for days on end, hike 100 miles, raid a building, seize a small town. Finally, in a last phase of training, the multinational Jedberg teams were sent to a manor house in Cambridgeshire called Milton Hall. One of the largest private homes in England, the manor had been donated to the cause by Lord and Lady Fitzwilliam. Oil portraits of Fitzwilliam family ancestors dating back to 1594 hung on the walls. In the massive sunken gardens, the Jedbergs practiced martial arts. In the converted dairy barns, they learned to decode cipher, feign deafness, use sign language, and transmit Morse code. In the manor's grand library, they watched Nazi propaganda films, a way to become familiar with how the enemy moved, spoke, and dressed. Milton Hall served as a kind of finishing school for commandos, one of the last stops before embarking on dangerous missions that many would not survive. Jan Kubisch and Josef Gabček trained at Milton Hall shortly before leaving on their mission to kill Heydrich. The final phase of Jedberg training involved parachuting infiltration techniques taught at Ultranum, Manchester, at a facility codename STS-51. This 3-day educational course included 3 live parachute jumps. The first, in daylight, was out of a balloon, flying 700 feet off the ground. The second was out of an airplane flying at an altitude of roughly 500 feet. The third served as a dry run for insertion behind enemy lines. In the dead of night, commandos jumped out of a plane flying at roughly 1,500 feet. On June 5, 1944, the eve of the Normandy invasion, the 1st Jedburgh team, codenamed Team Hugh, parachuted into Nazi-occupied France with instructions from Prime Minister Winston Churchill to set Europe ablaze. 92 Jedburgh teams would follow, including one led by Aaron Bank, now advanced to chief of guerrilla operations in France. The mission of these Jedburgh teams was to blow up infrastructure, kill Nazis, and disappear without a trace. In this way, the official motto of the Jedburghs became surprise, kill, vanish. In Texas, Billy Waugh learned about the Normandy invasion from the radio at his grandmother's house. Winnie Waugh lived directly across the street, and whenever Billy had the chance, he listened to programs like G.I. Live and This Is Our Enemy. On the afternoon of June 6, 1944, NBC Radio announced the D-Day invasion of Nazi-occupied France. Then came the newsreels of the Normandy invasion. The most amazing footage was of 1,500 airplanes dropping thousands of American paratroopers into France, their silk canopies filling the skies like balloons. To Billy, these operations were mythic, and when he heard that recruiting stations in Los Angeles, California, allowed boys of 15 to pass for older and join the war, he decided to run away and become a combat soldier. Billy Waugh packed a bag and hit the road, hitchhiking west out of Bastrop. He made it 650 miles to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where he was stopped along Highway 80 by a police officer. When he failed to produce identification, he was arrested for truancy and put in jail. The police said they'd release him only if he could produce enough money to buy a bus ticket back home. With no choice but to call his mother, Billy Waugh picked up the phone. His mother agreed to wire him bus fare if he promised to finish high school. Billy kept his word. This war would end without him, but he was now determined to become a U.S. Army paratrooper first thing after high school. In Europe, as part of a plan called Operation Foxley, the British Special Operations Executive conceived of ways to assassinate Adolf Hitler. One plot called for a sniper to shoot Hitler during his morning walk around the Berghof, his residence in the Bavarian Alps, using a Mauser Car 98K with a telescopic sight. Another plan involved sending a single commando into Nazi Germany to poison Hitler's food with an unidentified toxin, codenamed I. In the third plot, commandos would attach a suitcase full of explosives under the Führer's train car. But the laws of war forbade assassination, and many British generals worried that such a high-profile assassination could open the door to a war crimes trial. Not everyone agreed. On the pro-assassination side was Air Vice Marshal A.P. Ritchie, who told colleagues that the German people viewed Hitler as something more than human. To Ritchie, it was this mythical hold which Hitler exercises over the German people that is largely responsible for keeping the country together at the present time. In a bid for assassination, he argued, "Remove Hitler and there is nothing left." But Vice Marshal Ritchie was a minority voice. Decades earlier, in 1907, 44 nations had met at The Hague to formalize the laws of war as had been originally written in the Liber Code. In Laws and Customs of War on Land, Hague 4, assassination was further defined to include any form of treacherous killing. Wartime killing had sharp distinctions, the authors wrote, citing by example two contradictory ways to kill a general or king, one considered a treacherous war crime, the other a lawful killing. A soldier is forbidden to sneak into the tent of a general or king, disguised as, say, a peddler. But if that soldier is in uniform and is part of a small attacking force, then he is allowed and encouraged to kill the general or the king. One soldier is a vile assassin, the other a brave and devoted soldier, according to the Hague Convention. The reason for the distinction, the authors wrote, was to diminish the evils of war. And so, despite how arbitrary this and other prohibitions seemed to some, the British SOE plans to assassinate Hitler were scrapped. There was no way an SOE commando could operate inside Nazi Germany, wearing a uniform of the British Army, it was argued. But over at the Office of Strategic Services, the boldness of Operation Foxley inspired the OSS Chief of Secret Intelligence for Operations in Europe to devise a Hitler assassination plot of his own. The chief was a young American lawyer turned commando named William J. Casey, the same young man who'd broken his jaw and lost several teeth on the demolition trail while training for OSS Special Operations at Area B. To Casey's eye, if OSS was going to defy the laws and customs of war on land in order to assassinate Hitler, why stumble over a rule regarding uniforms? His audaciously deceptive plan, called Operation Iron Cross, was to insert an OSS commando team disguised as enemy soldiers wearing Nazi uniforms. To lead this five-man OSS team, which would be populated out of a battalion of turncoat Nazis, Bill Casey chose Aaron Bank. The two men had trained together back at Prince William Park in Virginia at Area B. After the war, Aaron Bank recalled Bill Casey describing Operation Iron Cross to him as the most important assassination operation of the war. The OSS had recently captured, turned, and trained 175 German POWs. These men, formerly avowed Nazis, were now willing to work for the OSS. In the winter of 1945, the plan was to have Aaron Bank, a four-man OSS team, and the captured Nazis parachute in behind enemy lines posing as Wehrmacht soldiers. The team, called the OSS Iron Cross Mountain Infantry, would hike through the mountainous terrain, locate Hitler's eagle's nest hideaway, ambush the Nazi leader, and kill him. But to command such a unit deep in enemy territory involved extreme risk. The drop zone chosen would be deep within the Inn Valley in Austria. There would be no backup air support, no infantry army to call. All it would take was one double-crosser, one Nazi POW still secretly loyal to Hitler, and the mission would unravel. In all likelihood, the OSS team, led by Aaron Bank, would be executed on the spot. Setting aside worry over the Hague resolution against treacherous killing, Bill Casey was concerned about a certain rule of engagement, ROE, issued by Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower, to whom he was fiercely loyal. General Eisenhower had forbidden the U.S. Army and the OSS from recruiting and hiring Nazi POWs for any kind of mission. Casey, skilled lawyer that he was, appreciated loopholes. By encouraging the captured Nazis to volunteer for the Iron Cross Mountain Infantry mission, he created a legal go-around that allowed him to proceed. As chief of OSS Special Operations in Europe, Bill Casey had authorized dozens of teams airdropped into this area. But he remained cautious about inserting the Iron Cross Mountain Infantry because he knew the area around Eagle's Nest to be heavily guarded by elite Nazi commandos. Still, Casey authorized Bank to begin preparing the team and await further instructions. At an undisclosed European location, Bank led commando training, teaching Nazi turncoats new infiltration techniques, including how to extract individuals from armored cars and how to storm a mock-up of the target. The plot advanced to the point where Bank was given a large sum of cash with which to pay bribes and a small gold ring to barter for his freedom in the event he was separated and captured. Each OSS operator was given a cyanide capsule, as Jan Kubisch and Josef Gabček had been. The prospect of killing Adolf Hitler caused Ehrenbank to lie awake at night thinking, "Wild thoughts, world-shattering in scope," he later wrote. If Bank's OSS team succeeded in killing Adolf Hitler, it would be the end of the war, because the German general staff would surely surrender. With no one left to command the army, wrote Bank, this would be the only time in history that five guys would be responsible for ending a major war. Bank continued to train the Iron Cross Mountain Infantry. He and his men conducted a dangerous dry run over the drop zone, practicing reconnaissance and exfiltration techniques. Then he waited and waited. The anticipation was excruciating. Storms hung over the Alps, first for days, then weeks. It was April 1945. Finally, Ehrenbank was flown to Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, in Paris, for a classified briefing with General Eisenhower. The U.S. Army had moved infantry soldiers into the Inn Valley. There were boots on the ground now, closing in around Eagle's Nest. Operation Iron Cross was canceled. Bank was devastated. To kill or capture Hitler was the opportunity of a lifetime. In a flash, it was gone. On May 7, 1945, the Nazis surrendered at a brief ceremony inside a schoolhouse in Reims, France. General Walter Bedell Smith, Eisenhower's chief of staff, officiated the historic end of the Third Reich. 3 months later, after the United States dropped two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Imperial Japan surrendered unconditionally to the Allies, ending World War II. 6 weeks later, on October 1, 1945, President Truman signed an order abolishing the OSS. Truman disliked William Donovan and his band of ungentlemanly warriors. In a curt memorandum, the president thanked Donovan for his service and wished him well. To President Truman's eye, America was the new standard bearer of democratic ideals. The U.S. military was the mightiest in the world. Soldiers of a democracy do not fight guerrilla wars. Gentlemen do not slit throats. In Bastrop, Texas, Billy Waugh took part in every victory parade. He'd stand on the corner when the parade began, waving his flag at the war heroes. Then he'd duck away from the crowds, race through an alleyway, and get back to the street in advance of the marching men. He'd repeat this action all morning or afternoon until the parade ended. Two local Marines, wounded in the war, were especially interesting to him. One had a wound to the head, and the other wore a cast on his leg. "Whenever I was near them," remembers Waugh, "in a street or a store, I felt awed to be in their presence. I admired their strength and nobility." 1 month after graduating from high school, Billy Waugh joined the U.S. Army as a paratrooper. He was off to Fort Benning in Georgia to learn how to jump out of airplanes. His whole life was in front of him, and it felt great.